What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
How y'all doing? I like that, y'all.
How's good. It going?
Good.
Doing great.
Great. Awesome. Here with Gabe Pacheco, also with Nathan Rosenberg.
That's his nom de guerre.
Nom de guerre, yeah.
Gabe.
Just added
him. Did I just out you, bro?
Oh my God.
It's his nom de passe.
Yeah. Nom de passe. Yeah. We're all pacifists here.
Exactly. So on today's episode, I spoke to Assad Haider. What a great name that is. It sounds like a real anti Bashar Assad. Mm-hmm. Nom de guerre. Mm-hmm. Nom anti-guerre, am I right? Mm. Except people who are anti-Assad more actually like want to remove him. So Assad Haider is a writer, former organizer, and he is the founding editor of Viewpoint magazine. And he wrote this great book called Mistaken Identities. So we talk about identity politics, and it's interesting because what a lot of people don't know is where this term came from, and its origins are very antithetical to the way it's used now. So that's a real, I don't know if I want to say anything else about that. I mean, I just maybe leave people out with that cliffhanger.
Listeners, what do you think of when someone says identity politics?
Yeah, write it out, send us an email, and then listen to the episode, but don't cheat. Wait, no matter what you do.
Let us get back to you and tell you how wrong you are.
Yeah, exactly.
Then listen to the rest of the episode. Yeah. It's a really interactive experience.
But Assad Haider gets called like a white Bernie bro, and Assad Haider's brother, Shuja Haider, also gets called a white Bernie bro. And it's just weird because it's like, aren't you, I'm not pro-racial. Here's a hot take. I do not like racial profiling. I'm anti-racial profiling. But you don't have to be like that smart to get that Shuja Haider and Assad Haider are names that are not white people.
Yeah. So it would almost be a weaponized form of identity politics to mislabel them as white bros.
Yeah, exactly.
A Bernie bro. That in itself is a weaponized form of identity politics.
It's invisibilizing, right? It's doing all the stuff that the people who claim to care about identity politics claim to oppose.
Like putting bro on the end of anything on Twitter makes you a dude, a white dude who's just not hip to the struggles.
Right.
To the rainbow sprinkle struggles.
Yeah. Oh, I want ice cream now.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. People say that about me, that I'm just carrying water for, you know, male socialists. I'm doing it for attention. People always
say this for
attention.
Are you a crypto bro?
I'm a crypto bro. I am. I'm the feminist Bernie bro. You are a Chicano dude bro.
I'm a total bro.
Yeah. Hermano.
That's right.
And if they wanted to pathologize me and my relationship to men, they really should just go with I'm trying to impress my dad, because I got the photo of 6-year-old Katie Halper in Washington, D.C. with both of her parents. But for some reason, I guess my mom was taking most of the pictures. So it's a lot of Katie and Jim. Mm-hmm. And we're at a NARAL rally and holding, you know, my body, my choice. That's kind of a weird thing for me and my dad to be holding. Mm-hmm. I think it was just like NARAL.
Yeah.
Before, yeah.
So is it like the Gloria Steinem line that you're doing it to impress young men?
Yeah. Or? Lots of people say that to me on Twitter. Yeah. I hold water for Chapo Trap House. So actually what I want to do is I want to take the picture of me and my dad when I'm 6. And my dad has this like Einstein hair, and I just want to put like Will Menaker or Felix Biederman or Matt Chrisman's face in it to show their theory what it would look like.
The prequel trilogy.
Yeah, exactly.
To Katie.
Yeah. So, yeah. So enjoy this, Assad hater. And to hear the rest of our interview with Assad, just go to patreon.com/the Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/the Katie Helper Show.
You know what it is.
You know it. Don't play dumb.
Yo, hop over that paywall.
Guys, over that paywall.
Find the black market feed. We fit enough hints for where to find it.
I like the idea of someone like pole vaulting themselves over the paywall. Okay. Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I'm your host, Katie Helper. You can hear the Katie Helper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's WBAI.org or 99.5 FM. You can also find us on SoundCloud, on iTunes, and on iTunes, please rate and review us. Find us on Facebook, just the Katie Helper Show on Facebook. Find us on Twitter. My handle is KT Helps. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. The handle of my co-host, Gabe Pacheco, is Gabe_Pacheco. You can use the hashtag KT Help Show. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S-H-O-W. And find us on Patreon, patreon.com/the Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/the Katie Helper Show.
I'm really excited to be talking to Assad Haider, who is a writer. He's a founding editor of Viewpoint Magazine, and he's the author of a book, brand spanking new, Mistaken Identity, Race and Class in the Age of Trump. It's a great book, and you have some really provocative things to say, which is always fun. So welcome, Assad.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Hi, Katie.
Hi. So I'm going to start with a really, really hardball question, which is, why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote this book because I kept encountering a kind of impasse or deadlock on the left, which is that people treat race and class as separate and opposed problems. And there's a whole tradition of radicals in the United States who saw race and class as inseparable. And that's the kind of tradition that I encountered and was politicized by, and I think is really relevant for today. And the fact that it's forgotten in these discussions that turn it into an opposition is just a real shame. So part of the purpose of the book is to revive that.
So why and how has it been suppressed?
Well, some of the ways it's been suppressed is that organizations like, let's say, the Black Panther Party or others that came after it are represented and appropriated in a way that suppresses their class politics, in a way that leaves their class politics out. It leaves out the fact that they saw themselves as part of a global revolution against capitalism. And a lot of people who are in more privileged positions or in elite positions in the United States want to call on that kind of legitimacy on the brand name of the Black Panther Party while suppressing the threat that they pose to their elite positions and to the economic equality they benefit from.
So one of the terms that's kind of essential to this discussion is identity politics. Can you shed some light on what that means?
Yeah. Well, so I think, first of all, that when people talk about identity politics, it becomes a kind of empty term because people fill it with whatever meaning they want to bring to it and with whatever kind of political agenda they want to bring to it. And it's become a big point of discussion now following the 2016 Democratic primaries, in which, was it 2016?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, suppressed memory, speaking of suppression.
Yeah.
Repressed memory, yeah.
So, I mean, Bernie Sanders came to represent class politics, economic inequality, whereas Hillary Clinton was the candidate who supposedly was the only one who cared about racial and sexual discrimination, and that got equated with identity politics. Identity politics is when you care about these other issues. And if you care about economic inequality, you probably don't care about those other issues. But that's a really ahistorical and kind of distorted way of looking at things. The origin of the term is with a group called the Combahee River Collective, which was an organization of mainly Black lesbians who were involved in various different kinds of social movements. They were involved in the feminist movement, or the women's liberation movement, as it was called at the time, the anti-war movement, the Black liberation movement, and the socialist and labor movements. And they said, look, in all of these movements, we find that our particular identity, which is really specific and has all of these different specific traits and specific forms of oppression that we're subject to gets excluded by the single issue kind of agenda of these different organizations. So if we organize autonomously and we assert our identities, that means that we break up that kind of structure of exclusion that's holding these different movements back. It means that we make it possible to have a movement that's about the liberation of everyone. So if Black women get free, then we all get free. And that's why the recent republication of their collective statement, edited by Kianga Yamada Taylor, along with a lot of interviews with founding members, it's called How We Get Free, because it's about how everyone can get free. And what that meant for their politics was that they were always building coalitions. They were building coalitions with feminist movements for reproductive rights. They were building coalitions with striking construction workers. And now identity politics has been turned into a way that my identity makes me separate from everyone else. And that is a total reversal of what they intended.
Yeah, it's a betrayal, right?
I think so.
Yeah. And it's funny, I feel like the way that people who are on the kind of Hillary side of this divide, and I know we have to get beyond the primaries, but it did expose a real rift that's still there. But people who use the word identity politics in a way to criticize, let's say, the Bernie people, their definition of identity politics is like identity except for class. Or when they talk about intersectionalism, which we can talk about, intersectionality, it's intersectionality except for class. And it reminds me of this term PEP, progressive except on Palestine.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, they're these, you can't really be that without having the other part in it. Like, you can't actually be an intersectionalist. You can't actually be someone who embraces identity politics if you omit a large part of people's identity.
Well, I think that, you know, the Combahee River Collective proposed the term identity politics for a very specific context with a very specific goal. And there's no need to cling to it in an entirely different political context when it's been taken up to mean something that's the opposite of the political agenda that they had. So, you know, some people want to speak about a radical identity politics and, a moderate identity politics or something like that. I think we don't need the term anymore.
We don't need to reappropriate it.
Yeah, what we need is their legacy of which is one almost of disrupting identities more than it is about claiming a fixed one.
Right, because as you said, the point is coalitions, not kind of separate movements. That is a tricky balance, right? Because how do you make sure that people's needs are represented or people feel like they're spoken to in a way that doesn't fragment movements?
Yeah, well, coalitions are necessarily between different organizations. I mean, coalitions mean that you approach a group which is doing something different, which is has different goals and different means of achieving them, and you say, let's work together and let's allow ourselves to affect each other and change each other. And that's how politics really happens. I think that's the lesson of the great successful liberation movements of the 20th century.
The 2016 primary really put out the idea that socialism or leftism is the kind of exclusive domain of straight white men. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the history of racial justice and anti-racist organizing that mm-hmm. existed, for instance, in the Communist Party mm-hmm. or in other areas of the left?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's interesting to note that the Socialist Party and the Communist Party were and the Industrial Workers of the World, for example, which became a big part of the Communist Party, were composed largely of immigrants.
Right.
And immigrants were slowly absorbed into this social construct, which we call whiteness, the white race. And I have a part in my book about the invention of the white race, which is the term of Theodore Allen. But the Communist Party especially came to realize that whiteness and white chauvinism, as they called it, was a major threat to organizing the working class, because it introduced a fundamental division between Black workers who were super exploited, who were subject to an extremely high-level exploitation because of the legal and violent forms of coercion that were added to the exploitation of the workplace, and that white workers, despite their exploitation, had been granted certain privileges that made them think that they were above this other level of exploitation, and therefore weren't joining in solidarity with others in a movement that could challenge the collective enemy, which was the bosses.
Right.
And so they started to organize specifically on the question of race. They organized anti-lynching movements, armed defense against lynching. They were part of they led the defense of in the Scottsboro campaign of 9 young black men who were falsely accused of rape. They organized some of the first integrated social gatherings in northern cities, and they called for the self-determination of what they called the Negro Nation in the South, in the Black Belt, which was a way of, you know, that's something that gets ridiculed a lot because, you know, race is not a nation or something like that. Both of these categories are social constructs. It's not like one of them is more obviously real than the other. Right. But the point of doing that was to connect the oppression of black people in the United States with a global revolution against colonialism. And so they put that issue front and center for a significant period. And unfortunately, as the Communist Party grew more and more conservative over the years, that was dropped. But they laid the groundwork, a large part of the groundwork, that would be utilized later on in the civil rights movement. So that legacy is fundamental. It stretches through the 20th century.
And even the way the civil rights movement is presented really emphasizes certain values and tendencies and strategies over others. And it's very whitewashed. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to look at the civil rights movement in a much longer perspective. It didn't just start with the Montgomery bus boycott. Because earlier than that, there was what the historian Jacqueline Dowd Hall calls a civil rights unionism. And that was about a kind of agenda that involved jobs for all, full employment, fair wages, housing justice, and things like that, alongside the demands to end legal segregation. And the figures like A. Philip Randolph, who was one of the major organizers of the 1963 March on Washington, were involved in this kind of thing since the 1940s. And then when you look at the classic kind of phase of the civil rights movement that we're all familiar with, the one that starts in 55 and basically goes until 65, it always had this kind of radical dimension of talking about poverty from the beginning. If you read the writings of Martin Luther King as early as the second half of the 50s, he's talking about this. He's talking about poverty. And he's also making the connection to the world outside of the United States. And a lot of people talk about how Martin Luther King, the last year of his life, April 4th, 1967 through April 4th, 1968, was really quite radical, because on April 4th, 1967, he gave a speech against the Vietnam War in which he said that there were the three evils of American society, which were militarism, capitalism, and racism. And
up here at Riverside Church in Manhattan.
Yeah, exactly. And at that point, he was involved in organizing the Poor People's Campaign. And when he was shot, he was in Memphis trying to support the strike of sanitation workers. And he really was, you know, that really came to the forefront in the last year of his life. But it was always there in varying ways. And, you know, he was, as his learning process continued, as he was involved in activism and learning from the new kinds of political events of the period. But right at the beginning, he made the connection to the Indian independence movement with Gandhi. And everybody knows that he gets the philosophy of nonviolence from Gandhi, but it's also a way of connecting the struggle of black people in the United States to the struggle of Indians against British colonialism. He always had that awareness.
That's interesting. I never thought of it. I just thought of the nonviolence aspect.
Yeah.
But yeah, of course, there's the internationalist,
exactly,
anti-colonial aspect. Can you talk about your own identity and how it's changed, or how your understanding of your identity has changed over time?
Yeah, for that I have to quote the great theorist of identity, Stuart Hall, who said, "Identity is not about returning to your roots, R-O-O-T-S, but about coming to terms with your roots, R-O-U-T-E-S." And I think that's what identity is about. It's not a fixed thing. It's about all the different roots and movements that we have had over time. So I could go back and think about some of my ancestors who migrated from Iran over into India. And then...
How long ago are we talking about?
Centuries. Okay. And then more recently of the of my family who migrated from India to Pakistan after the partition. And then of my parents migrating from Pakistan to rural Pennsylvania.
Typical trajectory.
Yeah. So it's that kind of movement across entirely different contexts and at every step involving mixing and mingling and changing. That's the kind of thing that constitutes our identities. And what I think is so... the reason I'm really cautious about retaining the word identity is that it doesn't get taken... it doesn't get understood in terms of this dynamic kind of process of movement and transformation. It gets understood as a fixed, stable thing, my essence, what's really inside me. And that hides this kind of movement, which I think is really constitutive of who we are.
It's interesting, though, because you talk about how your identity was either, I don't know if it was changed, the way you saw it was changed, the way other people saw it was changed on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And, right, I understand what you're saying about identity being this kind of false construct of a permanent thing, and it's not dynamic, but you also recognize that the way you are seen, right, is not fully up to you. Right? Mm-hmm. You're walking down the street, you're seen a certain way. So how do you balance both acknowledging the way that affects your life with looking at identity in the way that you really see it, which is not the way that it's used as a term?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's part of that kind of fixing of identity, which is that after 9/11, you know, people looked at me and thought, like, there's, like, a Muslim and that's, like, a threat to homeland security, and everything got kind of, like, reduced to that. All the other things, you know, it didn't matter that I was, like, into punk music or drank alcohol or ate bacon.
Right.
It just got fixed in terms of the specific political context. I think that defending people from that kind of racist imposition of identity doesn't have to mean accepting that kind of fixed idea of identity.
Did it create a sense of solidarity, though, for you between someone like you, a secular punk music listening to bacon consuming person, and someone who is religious and Muslim? Given that the world, in other words, you know, how after 9/11, right, there were attacks on Sikhs.
Yeah.
Or on Hindus.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, who have, not that it would be okay to attack a Muslim, but even within their racist view, it was just off. You know, even within the racist project, it wasn't the right demographic.
Yes, that's right. That was common then, yes.
Which, does that create an identity too? Like, when you're subjected to the same things, even though you're different, does that create some kind of solidarity, cohesion?
It can, yeah, though. I mean, I never really got interested in religion.
Right, so. No, right. It didn't.
But, yeah, but as you point out, the people from completely different religions got associated with, like, the Islamic threat, even though, I mean, if, in India, obviously, they're, like,
if
really
only they
big,
confuse those two yeah. groups, right?
So, but for me, it was more about solidarity with the tradition in the United States of fighting racism. That's when that really became meaningful to me. And that was something that was largely part of the Black Liberation Movement. And that really was meaningful to me in that context. And one figure who I think I connected with at the level of my Islamic background, the background of Islamic culture, was Malcolm X, you know, because he was a part of the Black Liberation struggle. And for him, Islam became a way of, this was at the end of his life, though there are traces of it before, Islam became a way of connecting with the Arab world and with, once again, making that internationalist kind of politics.
Did 9/11 politicize you? Were you already political and politicized in the way that you are right now? Or
I was sort of politicized just by by going back and forth between the United States and Pakistan and seeing just the scale of inequality of wealth that exists in the world and the level of poverty that existed there, alongside globally a level of wealth that would make it possible to eradicate poverty.
Right.
And that's what first, that was the basic underlying idea for me getting politicized. But then 9/11 really, I sort of really got thrown into it just because it was clear how narrow the understanding of politics was of the people around me who got swept up in kind of patriotism and were really ready to get on board with the war on terror. And I knew that there's like a whole rest of the world out there where people don't see it that way, where people even think of the United States as a terrorist kind of entity.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more about how the way identity politics is used today is actually diametrically opposed to the purpose identity politics was intended to serve by the people who started using that? So not just in the theory, but in kind of in the real world and in practice.
Yeah, well, one thing is that identities get separated and get represented as having their own separate and irreconcilable interests. And so you lose the idea that there can be a politics which is about everybody's emancipation. And you lose the idea that there's a way that everyone can get involved. And one thing that you encounter, especially if you're an activist, you're part of organizing scenarios, they could be, you know, a range of things. One thing you encounter is the idea that only certain people who are in the most marginal positions should speak or have a right to speak about the issue that supposedly is completely manifested by their identity. You get the kind of logic of the laundry list, which, you know, when people use the word intersectionality now, it's also kind of been turned upside down because it's instead of being a way of recognizing that intersectionality comes out of legal studies.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And so it's, and Kimberlé Crenshaw proposed this, that if you have an anti-discrimination lawsuit in which someone says, well, I was discriminated against because I'm a black woman, then the judge responds, well, you have to pick.
Right, which
either you were discriminated against because you were black or you were discriminated against because you're a woman. So intersectionality is the idea of saying, no, there's an intersection of these things and you have to describe the whole thing.
You really can't have it all, women. Lean in.
Right. But now when people talk about intersectionality, it's more about making the laundry list, which is to say, like, you know, as a, and I'm not going to list the things because then it will come off as offensive,
yeah.
But you list.
You could do your own stuff.
As my own stuff. As a bacon-eating Muslim, South Asian, heavy metal interested person,
right.
I don't think that this movement speaks for me. So I think that we should... we should have it split up.
I don't think this bacon tastes very good.
Yeah, well, that's rare. That's a rare...
No pun intended.
Yeah, there you go.
Wow, that was a beautiful moment. Yeah. I would have thunk it. So the idea is that your politics are just informed by your identity,
exactly.
Right? So you can only speak about something if you're a member of the group that's being affected, which...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that means you can't have coalitions the way that the Combahee River Collective did. And so they, when you read these recent interviews that Kianga Yamada Taylor did with them, they're really clear about this. They say, like, we never wanted this to be a way of just saying, we only work on stuff that's related to me, and if you're
right.
not like me, I don't want to be involved with you. And unfortunately, that's something that happens really often now and under the name of identity politics.
Yeah, and there's a real emphasis on the individual over mm-hmm. the collective or the universal. And you talk
yeah.
about universality.
Yeah.
But that's something I think we really see where people's kind of individual identities are the canvas upon which identity politics is painted. I had to finish that metaphor. You write, You write about Huey P. Newton, and you say, but what mattered the most to me was that Newton did not stop with his own identity. His experience led him beyond himself to take up a politics based on solidarity with Cuba, China, Palestine, and Vietnam. His example corroborated the Communist Manifesto, the vast poverty I'd witnessed in Pakistan, and the long history of racial oppression that echoed into present-day Pennsylvania went hand in hand. Any solution would have to confront them both. The insights of this brilliant thinker, Karl Marx, did not belong to Europe. They belonged to the whole world, to everyone who fought against injustice. They had been refined and developed in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, even here in the belly of the beast, amid the acid and bile of patriotism and evangelicism. Black Americans had shown that this legacy could not be geographically confined. So yeah, this paragraph has makes two really important points. One is that, you know, individual liberation can be just an individual liberation. It's not necessarily political. And in fact, the focus on individual liberation can take away from a more universal political project. And also the idea that there's something very infantilizing and fetishizing about the idea that, you know, Marx and Marxism is the realm of white men. It's very essentializing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't resonate with people of color. I mean, first of all, look at Castro and look at Mao,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But those are two ideas that I think have really permeated politics.
Yeah,
since the election, since 2016, especially.
When a politics around race and gender becomes reduced to individuals, that means it becomes about the advancement of individuals, you know, sort of in the American dream of social mobility. And that is not a politics which is about overcoming the whatever kind of oppression is experienced by the majority of people who fall under whatever identity category this social climber has. And so what you get is elite figures who claim that they're fighting against racism or fighting against sexism, when actually what they're doing is only in the interests of a very small minority of people who have gained entry into the wealthiest and most powerful minority of the population.
Right. And it further, like, legitimizes that system, right, by suggesting that, look, we can overcome these barriers. But
And they claim, look, we're continuing the legacy. We're continuing what the civil rights movement right. accomplished, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you're really not, because you're really leaving behind most of the people that the civil rights movement and any other liberation movement was trying to fight for.
Right. Like the Poor People's
exactly.
Campaign.
Exactly.
Which they're reviving now
mm-hmm.
with
yeah.
Reverend William Barber.
Barber, yeah, yeah.
Who I'd love to have on the show if you're watching. can you talk about, in terms of erasure, you have this irony where people who claim to really respect identity and identity politics, they also engage in quite a bit of erasure. In fact, I think, how long have you been white, according to these people?
I've been white since, I'm often converted into white in particular social situations in which white people have assumed that anyone associating with them must be white, because whiteness is like the basic minimum requirement for entry into the club. And that's weird. And it always reminds me of the comment, which I quote, of Joe Biden about Obama, this gaffe he made. He said,
one of his many gaffes.
Yeah, that Obama's so clean and articulate.
Right.
Right. And so this is like what white people tend to think.
To be fair to Joe Biden, he's very equal opportunity in his offensive gaffes. You know, he yeah. covers all demographics. So shout yeah. out to him for that. Yeah.
Right. But I think really there was something much more drastic that happened with the 2016 primaries, which was because of the polarization between, and I'm talking like now about like a kind of ideological polarization. I'm not talking about policies and all kinds of details that people could quibble about, but the ideological polarization between the Sanders and Clinton kind of platforms was one in which it was assumed that if you support the kind of efforts against economic inequality that Sanders really represented, that you had to be a white Bernie bro, right? And you know, I was not heavily involved in the Bernie campaign. I thought it was a real step forward because it introduced a lot of young people to a different way of thinking about politics, and it mobilized a lot of people to kind of change the political discourse and change the structure that we have in our two-party system.
And criticize capitalism.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that was a real step forward. The Democratic Party elite figured out a really effective way to suppress that. And that way was to say that if you align yourself with this in any way, you are a white Bernie bro, and you are ignoring problems of race and gender.
Right. You're not centering women, people of color, LGBTQ people, as if economic exploitation isn't, like you were saying in the beginning, with overlapping identities and intersectionalism and the impossibility of separating class and race. Like, if you understand how racism works, you get that economics exploitation is that much worse for people of color.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that is where racism shows up.
Yes.
A lot is in class.
Yes. And that's what happens when you shift the perspective away from the individual and individual advancement, and then you realize that there are very large populations of people of color whose most pressing needs have to do with restoring public works, with overcoming precarity of labor, with overcoming extremely low wages, with getting access to health care.
Right.
These are issues that really matter for people of color.
Right. So universal programs, ironically, are the most disproportionately affect people of color, right? So the Fight for 15, that's mostly women and people of color.
Yeah.
So when people try to present that as kind of privileging economics over race, it doesn't even do that. Like, regardless of your feelings about that or your thoughts about that, it doesn't even function that way.
Yeah.
So if you care about addressing problems, forget strategy for a second and organizing and coalitions. But if you actually want these problems to be addressed, you want to support these universal programs.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, we have to say that strategy matters in the sense that you have to make sure that your messaging is getting that out. And so if you have white socialists and so on who are tone deaf to these things and who don't try to highlight the tradition that we've had in the United States of people of color fighting for economic equality, that's a real error.
Yeah.
Because you have to be able to fight against this attempt to suppress.
Right. You're walking into their trap.
Policy.
You're
exactly.
like doing their work for them.
Exactly.
But also on the other side of it, you have strategy in terms of when you have universal programs, you are able to bring in people who may have resentments and racist resentments, right? You also make the programs that much less vulnerable to being cut. You know, I always think of like how Newt Gingrich didn't talk about Social Security queens, although he wanted to cut it. He talked about welfare queens. It's a way to, again, all these people who use identity politics as a term really, in theory, want to defeat Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And how do you think you do that?
Yeah.
You, it's like this refusal to deal with deplorables or undesirables is so counterproductive, even if you don't care about these people. You can think that, you know, white workers are the wretched of the earth. You could have no sympathy. You could have all sorts of classist, you know, ideas about them. You still, in theory, want them to vote for the non-Trump person.
Yeah. And the thing is, a lot of them don't vote. And the white people who voted for Trump often were people who had higher incomes. It's a real fallacy that we've had in this country that working class people who are white have inherently conservative politics. I mean, historically, they've tended to vote for Democrats, and rich people historically have tended to vote for Republicans. It gets muddled in the South.
Right.
It gets muddled in places where there's still the legacy of legal segregation, and where the poverty of the whole state sort of scrambles the political terms. But there's a diverse working class. There's a highly diverse working class which is disaffected because they think politics don't represent them. Politicians don't represent them. And if you want to if you want to defeat Trump, you have to reach the whole range of them. That means a whole range of programs that deal with their immediate needs.
Right. And there is this weird false dichotomy as if doing something that's universal somehow throws certain communities under the bus.
Yeah.
And it's the opposite.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
And it's a way of kind of preventing division and stigmatization, right? You no longer see people as receiving special treatment.
Right.
What programs, by the way, do you think any programs that are racially targeted or ethnically targeted or gender targeted, whatever the term is, are any of those necessary? Are there any things that class, more universal based programs don't address?
Yeah, I mean, you have to, I don't think in terms of policy, I think in terms of movements. Mm. And I think, you know, for example, when you've got a union movement, when you've got a labor movement and you've got a union at a particular workplace, it has to take up problems of discrimination that are racial and sexual.
Right.
You know, the union's role is to represent the people who are being not only exploited but also discriminated against. And so that's about having a broad perspective and I think in terms of movements in that way.
Focus or orientations, but not policy per se.
Yeah.
But right, so a perfect example is sexual harassment in the labor movement, right? That's one of the, Alex Press, I've interviewed her about this and spoken to her about it. And one of the biggest, most pressing issues for lots of workers is harassment that they face.
Yes.
So you can't really, if you want to have a real, you know, strong labor movement, you can't present those issues as being on the sidelines or unrelated to class.
Yeah, I mean, as early as the 19th century, the late 19th century, when you started to get a lot of unions that were, a lot of them were connected to the socialist movement in Germany. And you can read about this in one of the Viewpoint issues, the Viewpoint issue 5, in which my co-editor and I wrote an introduction in which we talk about this. Even in this classical kind of period of socialism and the rise of trade unions, that you had unions like the Union of Textile Workers, who were mostly women, and they were constantly going on strike against harassment by the manager. And it wasn't, I mean, there was no conception that that's different. So, like, they went on strike so that when a worker got pregnant, she didn't have to keep coming in. I mean, they actually saw those as economic demands.
Right.
And they're all anti-discrimination
demands. Of course,
demands.
Right. Yeah, that's so fascinating. Or like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, right, which happened here where majority, I mean, it was almost all women, largely immigrant, and they didn't have, they were locked into this factory and there's a fire. And
this is a big misconception, by the way, about Karl Marx's Capital. The book Capital has a lot of...
real beach read, by the way. Page turner.
It has a lot of kind of accounts of the class struggles in factories. And most of those workers in this period are women and children. And so he's actually talking about women.
So you're saying one of the myths is that he wasn't speaking to the experiences or realities of women and children.
Exactly. That just doesn't correspond to what was actually happening in Industrial Revolution England, which he was describing.
And he also, I mean, so there's an inherent gender aspect to the labor discussion, but he also talked about things like the family and you know, marriage,
especially
legalized
Engels
prostitution.
Did.
Yeah, Engels, yeah, his sugar daddy.
That's right.
There's also this weird thing, there's this really weird takeaway, which is that because there are racists and because white people can be seduced by racism, therefore class-based organizing will not work. And it's like, wait, don't you get it? It's the exact opposite. It's in a vacuum. Like, that's why we need to have class-based organizing, because if you don't have it on that, what else do people have to grab onto?
Yeah.
It competes directly with it.
Well, so the first part of it is that you need to make another political language available, another way of thinking about politics available that isn't right-wing populism.
Right.
But then the other thing that you have to do is you have to start to re-educate some white people who just don't get it.
Right.
And sometimes people who are socialists and who are involved in, you know, Bernie-type campaigns forget that part.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that part, then people aren't going to listen. I mean, if you have to be able to demonstrate that you are working on these issues because they're not separate.
Yeah. And there is a weird empathy that, like, is there's a lot of empathy among the left, or even with liberals, there's a lot of empathy, but it kind of ends with class. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're, and I hate saying this because it sounds like I'm being a self-pitying white person, but I have very little in common. If anything, I'm like a snob, honestly, if I'm going to check my privilege. I have very little in common with a coal miner in Kentucky, right?
Yeah.
But, like, there is a lack of empathy towards that person compared to the empathy that we'll see among people towards, let's say, a person of color who is homophobic. And I'm not comparing racism, so a racist coal miner and, let's say, a homophobic black person in the Northeast. Like, I'm not equating those two things, but it is interesting how people have this understanding of access and education and consciousness raising that kind of stops when we're talking about white working class people.
Well, I think there's a phenomenon which I find really disgusting, which is of white liberals who are totally woke on questions of race and gender and then are just completely contemptuous and will, use every stereotype about what they think are rednecks and hicks. And
how they deserve to lose their health care.
Yeah.
If they voted for Trump, right?
Yeah. And you know, most of them didn't vote for Trump.
Sure, right. And even the ones, I mean, the irony, again, is like, you can have contempt for them. It's not a strategic move to further alienate these people.
Yeah.
And again, with messaging, with anti-racist messaging and universal programs, you reach everyone.
Yeah. And a lot of those people, you know, are on strike right now.
Right.
And they've been, and those are transformative experiences. Those change the way people think about politics. That's the time when you can make coalitions. You can start to see people crossing boundaries. And so that's another thing. I said I think in terms of movements rather than policy. When you have a movement and you are really dedicated to overcoming racial division in the movement, and you're working and you come up with a demand or a program that is in the interest of a broad range of people, people learn to work together.
Right.
People learn to understand things from other perspectives.
And the common shared goals.
Yes.
And yeah, it's again, it's like people will often point to the racist practices or the exclusion of the labor movement, which existed, but we also have examples of really inspiring multiracial organizing from the labor movement.
Exactly.
But people don't point to that because that doesn't support their thesis that you can't actually use economic kind of campaigns or justice or movements to reach across barriers.
And part of that is because these days people barely know what a labor movement is. I mean, such low rates of unionization, propaganda that's been like a century of propaganda against the very idea of having a union has been very successful. And so that's part of why people don't know that this is an option, that a union can struggle for racial equality.
Right. What about being told you're white on Twitter? You have a twin brother named Shuja Hader, friend of the show, the Katie Halper show, and he is constantly being told he's white. He's a twin of yours, so I'm not sure if you guys get the same white diagnosis at the same rates since you're twins, but...
Well, I get it less because I spend less time on Twitter, which, you know, I try to influence him to do as well.
Shuja, this is an intervention.
Yeah, but...
And Shuja's a great writer and writes about similar things and also music, too.
Yeah. That phenomenon is hard to explain. I mean, if it's just a cynical ploy to discredit us, it's a pretty stupid one because we're obviously not white.
Yeah.
We have Muslim names and so on. If it's not a cynical ploy...
And you're not like Chechen, Muslims or whatever.
If it's not a cynical ploy, it's like a level of delusion that I can't... You know, I can't really grasp. I don't know. People are getting so swept up in their in trying. I mean, maybe the explanation is that white people get so devoted to displaying how woke they are and how engaged they are in allyship and identity politics that they totally forget. They lose their minds for a minute. And they're like, you know, you're just another one of these white people who doesn't care. And they don't even stop to check.
Hey, Assad hater, you're a terrible white wasp or something.
To
hear the rest of our interview with Assad, it gets pretty fun. Just go to patreon.com/theKatieHalper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/theKatieHalper Show.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.